watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP, Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP, Salida, WGDR, Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, or WZKW, Kingsville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Zoning, urban planning, and development incentives are the province of local and state governments, and most people don't follow the tedious details. But the devil can be in those details. What's at stake is how the physical space in our communities is to be used. What is the public good? Is development automatically a good thing, given the way development is usually carried out? Or rather, who does or doesn't benefit? These local battles reflect a larger battle that's been going on for centuries in various ways. Private property versus the commons. It's about home. Do we live in a community space that we love? Must we alter what we love beyond recognition in the name of development? How do we protect the place we live from changes we see as negative? These issues will be the focus of the program this week, From the Local to the Global. From east to west, hold you alive in this darkness and midnight. To begin, all these discussions exist in a context. Our ecosystem, our economic system, and the dead dinosaur grease, petroleum, that has had such an impact on how this all has developed. James Howard Kunstler, based in Saratoga, New York, is familiar to regular listeners of this program. He's part of a group of thinkers called the New Urbanists, who want to make communities livable, lovable, and ecological. And Kunstler sees the suburbanization of America not as an American dream, but as a disaster, one made even more serious as the cheap petroleum that fuels it runs out. His new book is The Long Emergency, Surviving the Converging Catastrophes of the 21st Century. The talk we're going to hear next was given at the University Bookstore in Seattle last month. James Howard Kunstler.
Thank you all for coming. And what we're going to do, I think I'm going to make some formal remarks. I'm not going to read from my book. You know, you don't want to hear me read. You can read yourself, can't you? Sure. But I'm going to make some formal remarks, and then we'll have questions and answers. And there's some rules for that. One is you don't have to just ask a question because it's not Jeopardy. You know, you can make a statement, but you can't make a speech. Okay? Also, you have to speak in a tone of voice that's suitable for a public gathering. You're not on a telephone with me. These other people want to hear your question too, okay? So with that in mind, I'll just begin. How many of you are... Oh, and one other announcement. Nice people who run the Post Carbon Institute are here tonight. Just came in from England. Just flew in from England, and boy, are their arms tired. And they are here. They have some information that they'll make available at the signing table when we're done. And it's a very worthy organization that has been an umbrella group for understanding the predicament that we face and put together a tremendous amount of material, taped interviews, and other stuff. So how many of you are familiar with the global oil production peak issue? Virtually most of you, virtually all of you. So I'm not going to belabor that. I will perhaps introduce an idea that hasn't been really paid attention to. And that is really the amount of oil that's left in the United States. Just for your information, the amount of conventional crude oil left in the United States, we have 28 billion barrels of conventional crude oil left in the United States, according to the United States Department of Energy. We use 20 million barrels a day. That's 100 million barrels every 5 days. That's a billion barrels every 50 days, and there are about 7 periods of 50 in a year. So we're using about 7 billion barrels of oil a year. We have 28 billion barrels left. So do the math and just reflect on that and what it would mean if for some reason we were deprived of the oil that we get from people who don't like us. And think about that. The global energy predicament is going to change everything about how we live. And there are a couple of things that I've noticed lately that I want to bring to your attention. And I call them the psychological impediments that seem to now be embedded in our collective imaginations that do not enable us to think coherently about the problems that we face. And one of them I call the Jiminy Cricket Syndrome. And that's the idea that when you wish upon a star, your dreams come true. And that's mostly what we're doing, you know? And that comes pretty clearly from some things that, that are self-evident about, you know, most of us have been bombarded by television commercials our entire lifetimes. And that's what that's all about, you know, wishing for things. It partly comes from the Spielberg movies. But wishing is not something I would want to deprive people of doing. I think it's important to wish. It's important to aspire to stuff and to want to accomplish things. But if all you're doing is wishing and not acting, that becomes a problem in your life individually and collectively as a culture. The second thing that is a big problem for us is what I call the Las Vegasization of the American mind. And that is sort of the source of that, or the essence of that, is the idea that it's possible to get something for nothing. And that's a dangerous idea, especially for a culture, for a society, because it doesn't comport with reality, among other things. And it tends to defeat all earnest efforts to actually accomplish something or to face a problem and to do anything, to act. And you combine the Jiminy Cricket Syndrome and the Las Vegasization of the American mind, and you've got a real collective problem. And I think that's partly responsible for our inability to even have a coherent public discussion about this tremendous problem we face. Another question I think that is appropriate to ask is, where is the leadership on this issue? You know, we have no political leadership, business leadership, and barely any science leadership on the issue of the global oil predicament. I think that there's another thing that's responsible for that politically, and in terms of business, we can explain it. You know, the dirty secret of the American economy for the last 20 years is that it's all about the creation of suburban sprawl. In other words, suburban houses, Mick houses, Mick strip malls, etc. The furnishing of suburban sprawl, the accessorizing of suburban sprawl, and the servicing of suburban sprawl. And if you subtract that from the economy, then there's not a whole lot left besides fried chicken and open heart surgery. And so our leaders are reluctant to broach the subject. And we saw this very clearly with Al Gore. I had been and continue to be associated with the New Urbanist movement for the last 12 years. And I knew these guys personally, the founders of the organization, the Congress for the New Urbanism. And they were briefing Al Gore 3 times a year for 8 years. You know, and when the time came for him to run for president in 2000, he didn't touch this subject with a stick. Because he was afraid of offending the home building industry, so-called. And indeed, the more than half of the American people who actually live in suburbia, he didn't want to diss them and their way of life. But the fact is, you know, whatever you think, it's kind of an interesting thing, because for the last 10 years, there's been this idea that the only reason we have suburbia is because people like it. And it's good because people like it. It's, you know, what the Jesuits used to call casuistry. It's good because people like it. But I think the truth of the matter is that the suburban project can be described as the greatest misallocation of resources in the history of the world. And that has led to yet another psychological impediment in our group thinking. And that is the psychology of previous investment. The psychology of previous investment. The idea that you've put so much, you've invested so much of your personal wealth and your collective wealth as a nation, as a state, or a municipality, or a community, you've invested so much of it in this infrastructure of daily living that you can't even imagine letting go of it or even reforming it. And so that prevents us from even thinking about what might happen, what might be the destiny of this way of life and all of the equipment that we've created to run it. Excuse me. I think that one of the chief characteristics of the suburban project for the last, since the end of World War II, is that it really has no future. And that's the fact that it has no future has been the reason that it lends itself to ridicule, because it's been one of the secret unarticulated agonies of the suburb is that it hasn't lived up to what it promised to be all these years. It's not country living. It's a cartoon of country living in a cartoon of the country in a cartoon of a country house. And it's not an accident that it all happened as television came into our lives and started to sort of hold our collective imagination hostage. And we're going to have to do something about this. And, you know, people sometimes complain that you know, I come in, blow into a town and do a talk and say, oh, you're so pessimistic. Can't you nourish us with solutions? Where are your solutions? And, you know, I'm not a doctor. I don't prescribe. You know, I can't give you 100 milligrams of alternative fuels. What I can do is give you, I think, a reasonable picture of what to expect and an idea of what a reasonable response to this predicament of the long emergency, as I call it, is going to be. And that response is that we are going to have to downscale and rescale and right-size and resize virtually all of the regular activities of our life and our culture. And that means we're going to have to reorganize agriculture, everyday commerce, schooling, the way we live in relation to each other, all of these things. It's a tremendous project. It's really the great task of our time. And we haven't even begun it. And one of the reasons, one of the reasons that we ought to be disappointed with the leadership is that there are some things we could have begun to do and we haven't. You know, I didn't hear John Kerry say a word about restoring the passenger railroad system in this country. You know, nothing would do more quickly to make a difference in our petroleum use than if we restored the passenger rail system in this country. Wouldn't be a very difficult project to do. We don't have to reinvent the choo-choo train. The rights of way are all there still, waiting to be reoccupied. You know, some of them have been paved over for bike trails, but we can use them again and have bike trails next to them. We can do that. It's a project that America would help Americans to feel more confident about facing the future. And the fact that none of our political leaders has talked about it tells you how unserious we are. And this is not worthy behavior of political progressives. What passes for political progressivism right now in this country is fairly idiotic. If we look, for example, at the progressivism of the environmental movement, at Amory Lovin's Rocky Mountain Institute, Amory has been working on a hypercar for the last 12 years, a hypercar that will get phenomenal mileage and that will, you know, not use a lot of oil. And guess what the consequence of that is? Yeah, it promotes the idea that we can continue being a car-dependent country. What could be more a bigger waste of time? What could be more counterproductive? And yet, those are our leading environmental organizations. It's not worthy of us. We have to do better. Progressives have to do better. We have to ask our political leaders to do better. We have to, you know, we have to be there when John Kerry or Al Gore or Hillary Clinton or whoever is there and say, why aren't you doing anything to restore the American passenger rail system, among other things. We're going to have to downscale, rescale everything. The cheese doodle and Pepsi-Cola formula for agriculture is not going to be working very well for us into the 21st century. We're probably going to have to grow more of our food closer to home. And there are tremendous implications for this. Implications even for people like the promoters of alternative fuels. And I had a kind of a wrestling match a few weeks ago by email with the biodiesel enthusiasts. They were ticked off at me because I dissed them at a college lecture in Middlebury. And they couldn't believe it. Why are you against us, dude? I'm not against them, really, but you know, when I started to explore the subject with them and realized what they weren't paying attention to, you know, basically the idea is we're going to devote a lot of cropland to growing these vegetable oil-producing plants, and then we're going to run the interstate highway system on it, right? Okay. So I said, you know, are you guys aware that industrial agriculture is probably not going to be doing too well in 20 years? And they said, well, yeah, sort of, dude. And I said, well, you know, one of the consequences of that is we're probably going to have to devote more cropland to growing crops for human beings because our crop yields will go way down when we're not pouring oil and natural gas on the soil to grow corn for Cargill. And they said, oh, like, you know, they're not thinking about it. They're, you know, we're probably going to be using more working animals. And I don't know how many more, maybe 2%, maybe 5%, maybe 7%, maybe 20%. We don't know. But they require a lot of acreage. You have to grow food for them, too. So, you know, I don't think we're thinking through the consequences of this. One of the consequences of the long emergency, and it's a rather unappetizing thing. There are going to be a lot of losers produced by this period of history, a lot of economic losers. They're going to be very angry. They're going to be full of grievance and resentment. They're going to be bewildered about the loss of their entitlements to the American dream, to the promise of the drive-in utopia will be withdrawn from them and all of its perks, and they'll be ticked off. Many of them may end up working in agriculture, you know? They may, because we're going to have to grow more food locally, and it is probably going to have to be more labor-intensive. You know, we're going to have the return of a class of people we haven't seen in this country for a long time, native-born, agricultural, laborers, and workers of different kinds. And we can't predict what the social relations are going to be between those workers and those disappointed, formerly middle-class people. That's the name of this new group of people, the formerly middle class. And we don't know what the social relations are going to be between them and the people who own the land and whether they'll continue to be able to own the land, because that's generally, historically, a recipe for a lot of social unrest and even revolution. And America is not so exceptional that we're immune to the tides of history. But, you know, the Jiminy Cricket syndrome and the idea that you can get something for nothing has been... very disruptive and made it really impossible for us to think straight. No combination of alternative fuels or systems for running them is going to allow us to run Walt Disney World, the interstate highway system, and America really as we're accustomed to running it, or even a substantial fraction of it. Not even a substantial fraction, not yet. There's not going to be a hydrogen economy. You know, as it has been sold to the American people, it's simply a hoax. And some of you may understand, you know, the technical reasons for that. There are many reasons, chemical reasons, scientific reasons, why it is unlikely to happen. We are going to do wind. We are going to do solar. And they're going to be important. But we're probably not going to run the interstate highway system in Disney World on them. They will probably tend to be local. They will probably tend to be used on the neighborhood and even individual basis. And that, too, you know, raises very troubling questions, political questions. Will the people who don't have turbines and solar arrays, will they be full of grievance against the people who do have them, the people who can generate electricity? You know, will they be fighting with them or in conflict with them? My own opinion is that the formerly middle class, you know, NASCAR Nation meets the Weimar Republic, is going to be so ticked off that they're going to vote for corn-pone Nazis to make America like it was in 1997. Now, that's only my opinion, but I think it's something that we ought to be. You know, a lot of my friends are wringing their hands about George Bush. Oh, he's like Big Brother. Oh, he's so terrible. You know, I didn't vote for him, and, you know, I'm not necessarily a supporter of him, but I think that we could do a lot worse, and I think that, you know, you may be shocked to find that we can do a lot worse than George Bush. I happen to think also that anything that is anything that occurs at the gigantic scale of operation is going to tend to not work very well in the long emergency. You know, whether it's giant corporations that rely on 12,000-mile merchandise supply lines and the warehouse on wheels that, you know, continuously runs on gasoline, or whether it's a big farm, a corporate Archer Daniel Midland, you know, 5,000-acre corn operation, or whether, indeed, even a centralized high school, and government. And so my friends and cohorts are wringing their hands over George Bush. You know, I think that we'll be lucky if the federal government can answer the phones, let alone regulate your life in the years ahead. You know, the politics that we really are probably going to have to be concerned about are the politics at the local and the regional level, because that's where the action is going to be. We are going to have to rebuild those local networks of economic interdependency that were systematically destroyed by the locust plague, the swarm organism of Walmart and Target and the national chain retail stores. And by the way, the American people were fully complicit in the destruction of their towns. They weren't passive victims. And I've been involved in many a Walmart battle over the United States, and every one of those battles has a contingent of local people who want Walmart. You know, they want bargain shopping. They want to save $7 on a hairdryer, and they don't care if they throw out $600,000 or $6 million of their civic life and civic amenity to save those $7. We're going to have to reorganize those local networks. It is going to be very difficult. It's going to be a tremendous assignment for us. And, of course, we're going to have to make some big changes in how we live and where we live. I tend to think that the smaller towns and the smaller cities are going to do better than the larger cities. I think that the larger cities are exactly what they seem to be. They are products of the hypertrophy of the 20th century, fed by the nutrient medium of cheap oil. And the cities tend to be overburdened with megastructures and skyscrapers and things that we really don't know whether we can run these things. Skyscrapers and megastructures, even 10-story apartment buildings, are experimental building forms that have only been with us in the fossil fuel age. And we have to be particularly concerned about the depletion of natural gas. Because that's how many of our megastructures are heated in that part of the country where that's necessary. And, you know, you can't have space heating in a 12-story or 30-story apartment building. You can't just heat a few rooms, stay warm there, because the whole idea of modern plumbing depends on being able to heat an entire building. You know, if it's 30 degrees in one part of the building and the pipes burst, that's pretty much it for the whole building. So, you know, Many of our cities, by the way, and this is self-evident, are in an advanced state of decomposition already. You know, if you go around the country, as I do, and you see places like Kansas City and Detroit and St. Louis and Milwaukee, you know, you see what has happened to our cities. The geopolitics that we face are also daunting. There are some people who seem to have gotten the idea lately that I'm a supporter, that I'm a cheerleader for the Iraq war. And I don't think that's true. I've been trying to describe what I think the Iraq war is, but that's not the same as being a cheerleader. I'll try to describe it here again. It's a desperate attempt on the part of our country, our leaders, to stabilize a part of the world where two-thirds of the remaining oil is. In effect, we opened a police station in Iraq. And we opened it there because it was the best candidate for that police station. It had a leader who was widely regarded as a maniac, even by people who don't like us, who was widely disliked. And for whatever reasons, that was our selection for the siting our police station. Secondarily, we embarked on the Iraq adventure in order to modify and influence the behavior of two important neighbors, Iran and Saudi Arabia. And that's what it was about. The real question is, how long can we remain there? How long can we occupy unfriendly countries? And how much unfriendlier will they become while we're occupying them? And how many can we occupy at a time if we have to? And I think that that is a project that we can't feel confident about. Sooner or later, we're going to have to not be there anymore. And whether it's 18 months or 3 years or 6 years or, you know, you pick the figure. Whatever it is, isn't really a long time. And what happens when we withdraw? And also, to step back a little bit, how much of a state of exhaustion and bankruptcy will we find ourselves in as that occurs? Because that will happen to us. You know, as incrementally we lose American soldiers' lives a week, you know, every week, grinding on 52 weeks a year for 36 months, 6 years, whatever it is. That will be a very, that will be a process of attrition. So sooner or later we may face the prospect of withdrawing from the Middle East and not facing the prospect of not being able to control those unfriendly nations. What happens then? Do we lose our access to that oil, to even being able to buy it? Maybe. And what happens when that what happens then when we are back with our 28 billion barrels, or maybe 24 billion, or maybe 19 billion barrels of conventional crude oil that we have left, that we're still burning at the rate of $7 billion a year? Because I'll tell you something else. The people in Dallas and Atlanta and Houston and Northern Virginia and Southern California and Washington State are not going to stop driving. They're not going to stop making those 60-mile-a-day commutes, you know, unless they lose their jobs and they don't have to do it anymore. And then we'll be faced with the prospect of a lot of economic losers, and that's not a happy prospect either. I have friends in back where I come from, in upstate New York, who are, you know, very anti-war. I have to ask them politely to take the bumper stickers off their SUVs that say "War is not the answer." Some of them I've actually, you know, I had to come out and say, "By the way, war is the answer. It's the answer for you. Get used to it." What happens with China? China, you know, two-thirds of the remaining oil is in the Middle East, and another substantial portion of it is in Central Asia, in particular the former Soviet republics, Kazakhstan. China can walk into Kazakhstan if they want, and they may, because they're more desperate for oil, arguably, than we are. They actually have less of it, and they are still undergoing economic growth in the conventional sense of the industrial sense of it. Are we going to have a land war with China in Asia? That's not a project we can feel confident about. So, you know, these things have tremendous implications for us. And I think that the only thing that we reasonably can do is prepare to live differently in this country. We have traditionally been a brave people and a generous people and an earnest, hard-working people who did not expect to get something for nothing, you know, who did not believe that life was just a matter of buying lottery tickets. We actually had to act and do things and make things happen. And, you know, for a couple of decades now, I think we've sort of lost that. But it doesn't mean we can't recover it, and I think we may. I'm actually not pessimistic. I'm actually a rather hopeful, cheerful person. I think that there will be many benefits to the hardships that we face. And it may allow us to become a more serious people again and a people who are engaged in work that is meaningful with other people who are close to us in communities that are meaningful to us. And we will not be expending all of our spiritual energy sustaining a set of ideas that are only pernicious and ultimately militate against everything that evinces living in life, you know, and not being caught up in what has really become a culture of death apart from even the question of war. That's it. I want to thank you very much for your attention.
That was James Howard Kunstler, author of The Long Emergency, Surviving the Converging Catastrophes of the 21st Century. He spoke last month in Seattle. Thanks to Mike McCormick for that recording. A few weeks ago on the program, we aired a story about a struggle to save a unique green space in the city of Ithaca. It's known as the Redbud Woods, and Cornell University wants to bulldoze it to construct an 176-car lot for its West Campus development. Almost everyone is against the parking lot, from the city of Ithaca, which fought and lost a multi-year court battle to students, faculty, and community members. In our last story, we spoke with some of the student and community activists who are engaged in direct action. They've been occupying the woods since the spring, in some cases putting their bodies in the way of construction crews with chainsaws by locking themselves to the trunks of trees or living on platforms constructed in the canopy to keep the trees from being felled. At the time of our last story's airing, Cornell President Jeffrey Lehman had been ousted, and the interim president, also a former president, Hunter Rawlings, had not yet stepped in. Rawlings is now in place, and he made a statement last Wednesday expressing his determination to proceed with the controversial parking lot. Last Friday, more than 50 people were cited for trespassing as Cornell erected heavy chain-link fencing around the woods. Among those ticketed were a former mayor of Ithaca and a current Tompkins County legislator. About 30 student and community activists remain inside the fence as of this weekend, July 17th. Professor Jane Marie Law is one of the faculty members who was cited for trespassing. Law is Associate Professor of Japanese Religion, a former head of the Religious Studies Department, and the recipient of multiple awards for her teaching excellence. She was part of the faculty delegation that met with President Rawlings to propose alternatives last week.
Last Tuesday, a group of faculty got together and felt that we should present an alternative. Many alternatives have been presented and rejected, and the faculty group drew up a proposal to Hunter Rawlings, which called for the formation of a task force that would be appointed by him or by the dean of faculty, consisting of members of the administration and members of the student group and the faculty working group, with the understanding that there would be a 6-month period of time during which that group would ask whether or not the lot needed to be located here and if there were alternatives. And one of the things that's important about that agreement was that if it were determined that the lot were necessary there, all members would agree that that decision was binding. We presented that to Hunter Rawlings. It was presented by Tom Eisner and Paul Houston. And the next day, we were called to Hunter Rawlings' office, a group of faculty. Marty Hatch, Professor Marty Hatch, Professor Elizabeth Saunders, Professor Abby Cohn, myself, Tom Eisner, Professor Tom Eisner, and we went into Hunter Rawlings' office, and it was 2:30 in the afternoon. We were told by him that Cornell had a wonderful record of sustainability, but he had decided to go ahead with the lot, at which point police standing right outside Redbud Woods were notified to go in and start securing it. Immediately thereafter, Marty Hatch and Elizabeth Sanders stood up and walked out. We had probably been in his office a couple of minutes. They walked out. I stayed for a couple of minutes to find out what was going to happen to students and when was construction going to start, and he said, soon, very soon. We ran down to the woods, and the woods was already being secured with a snow fence. We sent out an email. I actually called my son, my 13-year-old, and had him dictate it into my email list. And within about an hour, we had about 100 people show up. The area was secured Friday. It was just sort of a crisis scene. Friday morning, we were told that there would be citations delivered to anyone who crossed the line, and the construction of a security fence went up. The security fence was poured concrete posts with drills, jackhammers, and the students and faculty, I think it's really important, the students are the leaders of this protest. They have been joined by townspeople and faculty. They're the powerful leaders of the protest movement, but it's important to understand that this isn't just a few ragtag students protesting this. There's a large group of brilliant students, and they're joined by faculty and people from the town in their protest in the woods. Yesterday, citations were delivered. I think at the end of the day, there were 60 or 70 citations given. People were standing in line to get them. I received one. Professor Tom Eisner came in. He's an eminent entomologist. He's probably Cornell's sort of crown jewel in ecological studies. He's a brilliant, brilliant scholar. And he's an elderly man. He came in and got a citation. The former mayor of Nichols got a citation. So large number of faculty, all the students receive citations. Today the fence is a little less penetrable, although people can still go in and get citations. And at this point, we have not in any way, shape, or form given up hope that we can save Redbud Woods.
Tommy Bruce, Cornell's Vice President for University Communications, told the Ithaca Journal on Friday, quote, "We have looked at everything," in reference to opponents' assertions that the university has failed to explore all alternatives. Faculty members feel that the administration is only going through the motions of consultation, and bitter feelings are spreading.
So the cost analysis that they have done is they've said, faculty goodwill, we can dispense with that. That's a low-budget item. In fact, we figured out it's got a price tag on it, it appears, from the public statement that Hunter Rawlings sent out. Everything we've done appears to be worth about $50,000. That's what they offered to any faculty members who want to come forward. There's to come up with good ideas to help Cornell with sustainability. Divide that by the number of faculty who have opposed that. Our protest is each worth about $1,100, $1,200 bucks. You know, I mean that was offensive to a lot of people. It was offensive to a lot of people who, in fact, didn't care about the parking lot. And what we're saying is, don't do this lot, and we'll give you a whole think tank. The discussions about this site and negotiations with the faculty have been going on for years. The faculty called for a moratorium. What was the date of the moratorium that was called for? Earlier this year, they called for a moratorium, and it was rejected by President Lehman. A letter several years ago came from Tom Eisner and Professor Leopold, basically saying this area needs to be preserved. Rebuffed communications would probably be a better way of putting it. The university has never entered into any negotiations with the faculty. They have ignored the expertise opinion of people in city and regional planning, horticulture, entomology department, biologists, people in the humanities, people in the social sciences. Across the board, they have rejected expert opinion. And what's sad about this is the very people whose opinions they're rejecting are the very same people other places hire to come give expert opinion on things. Cornell is famous for its city and regional planning and its environmental studies and its ecology. That's really been its strong suit globally. It's one of the reasons Cornell is ranked one of the top universities globally is because of the strength of those departments. So that's the very faculty that are being ignored. And when we use the word negotiations, Susan Murphy, who's vice president of student affairs, who's ended up being a major decision maker here, it appears, or implementer of Hunter Rawlings' decision, told me, she said, I'm very sorry you felt you were in negotiations. And I think what that meant was that we weren't negotiating with you, so therefore I took that there was really no need to honor sort of the decorum of listening to people who are stakeholders in a shared process. So that breakdown happened on Wednesday, that breach of trust happened on Wednesday. My trust has been totally breached, and I think I speak for a lot of faculty and students who feel that way, that I have never felt more alienated. I did have pause the other night when I asked late in the evening, I asked Susan Murphy to guarantee me that no student would be hurt, and she refused to give me that guarantee. In fact, I said, do you promise that you will not use pain, compliance, and violence against any of these nonviolent protesters? I asked her that four times, and finally in the end she said, not if they resist. The end question was, I asked her, does that mean you condone the use of pain, compliance, and violence against students? And she said, yes, if they resist. And I stayed up late at night wondering whether or not I could, in all good conscience, work for a university that would use pain and violence against protesters for a parking lot.
And everyone acknowledges that Cornell has a parking problem. Cornell presently has about 10,000 parking spaces. And the 176 spaces planned for the Redbud Woods would not significantly impact the situation. The planned lot is part of a large-scale redevelopment plan for the West Campus to further a project where students and faculty commingle and education can take place on a more personal basis. Ironically, the bad feelings generated by the administration's approach may jeopardize the key ingredient of the plan, faculty participation.
A lot of what happens at the university is dependent on faculty agreeing to participate in dining discussion groups. That's what West Campus Initiative is all about. It's called a living and learning environment. And the idea is that faculty will live there, faculty will be very involved there, and a lot of us are saying, and that's all volunteer, that's not in our contracts. That's all stuff we do because we love it. And people will be thinking about other venues. Getting involved with this group of students doesn't require participating in those formal initiatives. This was West Campus Initiative was an attempt to architecturally institutionalize a pedagogical idea. So the idea is that you are creating a community that is a residential community and a learning community that includes faculty and students. And that pedagogical idea I'm into. I think it's a really good idea. I don't know that you can architecturally legislate it. I think in a sense it happens. I'll tell you, it has certainly happened among the Redbud Woods protesters and the faculty working group. I mean, we sort of operate as one big unit with all the sort of one big, fairly happy, fairly functional family of people. The other thing you need to realize is that universities are operating as businesses to attract the $32,000 a year it now costs to go to Cornell. They're competing with a limited group of people who can pay that, and they want to make sure they get as many of the students who don't need financial aid to come here, and the rich kids from, you know, privileged, entitled families want to bring a car, they want to have a dorm that's private, that has their own pool and all of that thing. Thinks the university, the people, thinks the administration who's in favor of this lot. My sense is that I teach those students. I know the students we have here, and we have a great diversity of students. And rich kids from entitled backgrounds are no more inclined when they come to college to want to recreate the life they came from than kids from dairy farms out in Palmyra. And I have those students in my classes, and I know them very well. They come, and students really enjoy the opportunity of being in what a university is, which is an equalizer and it diversifies people. And this idea that we have to craft a university for the rich and famous, which is what I think this lot expresses, and the radio audience can't see, but the other people in the room are nodding their heads. that's sort of what's at stake in this lot. And the arguments given, first they were said, well, we need it for female safety. And we said, well, it's going to be actually a very unsafe lot because it's going to be overgrown. There's going to be a lot of trees and bushes planted around it, you know, as plantings to sort of make it look doctored up a bit. It can't have huge lights on it because city of Ithaca is right on the other side. It's a residential neighborhood. You're putting a parking lot in a residential neighborhood. One of the faculty members on the faculty working group, who's been a main organizer, Professor Stuart Davis, sent out a questionnaire to the faculty in the working group. He basically said, you know, the purpose of this is to make West Campus user-friendly, supposedly. Their argument is, we have to have this or no one will ever come to West Campus. And so he said to faculty, are you willing to come to West Campus without parking? What are you willing to do in West Campus without parking? And we all pledged great promises of, we'll come teach classes, we'll come give lectures, we'll come have meals with students. Everything West Campus is about, we promise to do without parking.
Given that the destruction of the woods has angered some of the very people Cornell needs to realize the West Campus initiative, many are perplexed by the administration's determination to go through with the parking lot and asking whether there are other motives.
Our sense is that there's a small cabal of people, a very small cabal of people, that could consist of just Hunter Rawlings, Mr. Meinig, who's head of the Board of Trustees, and maybe a couple of other trustees who have said, we're moving in and clearing them out and paving the lot. And there's an intransigence that boggles the imagination, because it's apparent to us that there are members of the administration who have agreed to take a hands off on this, but personally appear very distressed. And I won't name names, but it's very clear to me that there are a lot of distressed people. Our sense is that we keep hoping and appealing that President Rawlings will see the error of this decision. He could, whether or not he's the person making the decision, he could reverse it. A decision tomorrow from Hunter Rawlings with his signature only on it would stop the destruction of the woods. He doesn't need to ask anyone's permission to stop the construction of parking lot. I keep thinking there's a missing piece to this that explains this intransigence. And here's my speculation about the missing piece. In April or May, the Transportation Department sent out a survey, and I always fill out those little online surveys. And in it they said, what would you like to see in a multi-storied car park? Would you like to see a fitness center? Would you like to see a discotheque? Which made me think that the people putting this together are really out of touch. Would you like to see a sushi bar? I seem to remember there was a sushi bar in there. Maybe that was on my wish list. Would you like to see childcare? Would you like to see a drugstore, a dry cleaners? I remember the drugstore and dry cleaners. So I'm thinking, so where are we going to put this? You know, where are we going to put this multi-story, you know, facility with a movie theater? And my sense is that this is a placeholder. This parking lot is a placeholder, because Cornell has the 9 acres of the Treeman Estate and 6 acres from the Ezra Cornell Estate, which, if you're looking at it from a map, from a trustee's office in New York City or Denver or California or L.A., you're going to say, what's this big chunk of undeveloped urban land? That's in need of development. And what you could do development-wise with this land, development-wise, from a dollars economic model, you could build a mall, for goodness sake. I mean, you could build a whole Cornell Mall there. And so my sense is that the parking lot is, get people used to the idea that the space isn't a woods anymore, and it's not Ezra Cornell's mansion anymore, and it's not the Treeman Estate. It's a parking lot.
Greg is one of the Cornell alumni who has been organizing to save the woods. He also suspects the administration has more at stake than a place for 176 cars.
Parking lots are remarkably good placeholders for further development. I mean, it's very intrusive, but it's not as visible as putting a dorm right there. I don't think it sounds too much like a conspiracy theory to say that this is not the end of development in this portion of Cornell campus. I think there's just this great drive to sort of brush off any checks that might be put in place on Cornell's development. And they say that there are no alternatives. They actually discussed in the environmental impact statement a couple of different places where they could put this lot. I know one of them, I don't remember all of them, but one of them was the parking lot on Stewart and Williams. They could turn into a garage. And I think what they said is it would really meet the needs, but, oh, it's closer to College Town and, you know, that may be needed at some point, so we can't go there. I think it's the idea that, you know, if Cornell is actually saying, okay, we're not going to put this lot here, it means that their hands are in some ways tied when it comes to going further into the University Hill neighborhood.
Lauren, not her real name, is a professional urban and regional planner and an alumna of Cornell, and part of the effort to save the woods. She acknowledges that there is no quick fix because while Cornell has too little parking, Ithaca's roads are already clogged with Cornell traffic.
B-Lot is a fairly large lot. If they were to put four stories of, you know, 250 cars each, which is not that much more than what they were proposing for Redbud Woods, their original proposal was, I think, much closer to 200. And if they were to do four stories, they could easily add 1,000 car capacity to campus. However, the road system around here would not be equipped to handle another 1,000 cars on it. So I think that one of the reasons that they want this lot in this place is because there really is no parking in this area for a good reason. It's a residential area. Most of the parking is located on the eastern side of the campus, and that adds a significant traffic burden out there. And so if they were to add more cars to the road there, I mean, you would have traffic jams lined up everywhere.
Professor Law.
One of the arguments Cornell uses is that the town people want them to do that because they're tired of the students parking on their streets. And the people who live down in Fall Creek and across the street, in fact, the person, David Kramer, who owns all the houses across there, and Joanne Lukes, who owns a house right across from here, a beautiful historic home, have all said, we don't want this parking lot here. We don't want this parking lot. And the second thing is that one of the things that we want is a ban on freshman parking. We would like the university to give a free bus pass to every student who comes here. It would be great for Tompkins County if students could get around and do some of their shopping out. When I first came to Cornell 17 years ago, people used to have this joke about Cornell. They said you can always tell what year a student is by how strong their calf muscles are because there's so much walking here. And a few years ago, I said that to a student. I said, oh, you can always tell what, and she had never heard what I was talking about. That sort of Cornell joke died as we became a car culture. And you know, the thing is, right now we have maximum buy-in to these alternative plans because we can say to people, we're saving an historic woods. And what you can do to make that happen is to support a shuttle idea. Now, there are minimum shuttles, you know, running around, but a maximum shuttle system really set up. It would be great for TCAT, for the TCAT system to have, if all of a sudden they had an additional 10,000 users a year, they could add a lot of routes. The way Cornell controls parking right now is by making it very expensive. At the University of Colorado, where I was an undergraduate, parking was dirt cheap, but you had to have an expressed economic need for it. So it was actually a very good system. You had to prove you needed your car for work. If you were a staff member, you had to live so far from the university to get parking. And I think that a lot of the staff, the university's kind of played a little class card here, I think, a bit, trying to get the staff to turn against the faculty and students in favor of the parking lot. I strongly feel that, I mean, there was a police officer who told me the other day rather belligerently that, you know, he lives way out in the country and he's got three little kids, one of whom is sick. And I said to him, and you should have a parking place right next to Barton Hall. That should be a priority. They should prioritize spaces based on need. I used to, 2 months ago, say I think this is a fabulous place to be. I'm having a hard time saying that right now because I think the administration has so poisoned the climate here is now very poisoned with invasive bad feeling. That's our most dangerous invasive species right now. Yeah. Is faculty student alienation from the administration.
Yeah, I'm starting to feel a bit ashamed of being a Cornell alumnus, and I mean just being involved with Cornell is something that has always given me an immeasurable amount of pride. I got a wonderful education here. I had a great time, and I feel like I've learned a lot, both from the school, the town, and all the people that I've interacted with. But this whole situation makes me rethink the way I look at Cornell, how I relate to it, and basically what it thinks of me and people like me.
I would agree with that. I first came to Ithaca a long time ago, and I was here looking at Cornell as a university. I came on one of those beautiful spring days where the air is just crisp and the sky is blue, and I came here and I fell in love with it. I fell in love with the school. I fell in love with the community. It's quirky, and I feel like I fit in here. I feel like I've received an education that probably puts me in the top fraction of a percentage in the world, and I'm so thankful to my family that has sacrificed to allow me to get here, and to my professors who sacrificed their free time, to my teaching assistants who pretty much sacrificed their sanity for me. It's been an absolutely incredible experience. And then I found out that they would be building a parking lot on this site, and I was familiar with this site, and at first I was a little concerned. I was even more concerned when Cornell began suing its way through Ithaca in order to get its way. It's really been a project that's been elbowed through with opposition from pretty much everyone. You know, the city planning board, I believe the city administration as well has come out on the record, the historic preservation committee, and all of a sudden I became a little embarrassed that I was associated with this. And now that I'm a member of the Ithaca community, I'm even more embarrassed that my tuition dollars, my parents' very hard-earned money, are being used to build this parking lot. And not only that, to destroy the relationship between Cornell and my community, and not only that, to stubbornly and pigheadedly refuse to admit that they are wrong. And so my embarrassment has transformed into disgust, just absolute disgust. I cannot conceive of giving money to this university if they are going to continue to act in this way. And so I've made a very firm decision that I will not give any donations to Cornell, period. And every time Cornell contacts me to ask me for money, I will tell them the exact same thing. And I'll ask to speak to their supervisor because I want this message to get all the way up the administration that you are shooting yourself in the foot.
Lauren's feelings are shared by many other Cornell alumni, especially those still living in the area.
There was a petition that was passed around encouraging alumni to withhold their financial support to the university. I don't recall how many signatures we got on that.
It was over 500.
And there was also one that suggested that alumni reconsider their financial commitment to Cornell. I think that there are most of the people who are very deeply involved in this are also members of the Ithaca community that stayed in Ithaca because they love Cornell and Ithaca so much. And so the administration is just, they are complete idiots to be driving away the very people that would want to support Cornell the most. I mean, we stayed here because of the climate that Cornell gives this community. And they blew it, as far as I'm concerned.
And I also want to make it clear, there was this petition going around that was then presented to the administration, and their attitude in receiving it was, we don't care. We don't care how many signatures you have, who they're from, students, staff, faculty, alumni, community members. They in essence said, we're not going to hear their voices. This is our decision, and we are the ones making it.
And that's an extremely dangerous gamble.